Okay, thanks, Mark. So I'm Pete Binfield, and for about the last 3.5 years, coming up on 4 years, I guess I've been running PLOS One. Although I also do the community journals at PLOS, which Phil heard from yesterday, is one of our EICs. So, like Mark said, so PLOS One has blazed the trail of this open access mega journal phenomena. So I thought I'd quickly explain to you how PLOS One works, where it sits in the context of PLOS, show you some of our performance and quality metrics, how we're actually doing, tell you some of the lessons that we've learned. I'm pretty aware that this room's full of people who are either launching their own versions of these things or thinking about it, so we've got some lessons learned that should be interesting for you, and speculate on where it might be going. Okay, so the PLOS, and probably most of you in this room know this, we're about 8 years old now. We're the largest not-for-profit open access publisher. We publish 7 journals, of which PLOS One is obviously the biggest. We're based in San Francisco, so I'm actually in San Francisco, not Cambridge. We have to do that because me and Mark look so similar that if we were in the same office, we would annihilate each other with our facial hair or something. And the organization's been self-sustaining since last year. So a lot of that obviously has been down to PLOS One's growth. So this is where PLOS has come from. They launched, obviously, originally with PLOS Biology and Medicine back in 03 and 04. Then the four PLOS community journals launched around about June to September 05, and NTDs was a couple of years later. And PLOS One was in December 2006. And the progression, as it were, of content within PLOS is the top two were highly selective journals that were designed to prove that high-quality content could be published in an open access environment. The remaining four in the middle, the four community journals, are effectively what you might expect for any sort of decent-sized society journal. They're structured very traditionally. They have an academic editorial board, editor-in-chief, and a whole hierarchy, and they're also selective. And then PLOS One, obviously, is its own thing. And there's a quote here from Harold Varmus over a year before it launched. PLOS One was intended to be a very large compendium of papers that have been vetted for scientific quality, but which will not be confined in terms of their likely importance. And certainly we've managed to adhere to that all the way through now. So some of the essential features, I guess, of PLOS One, I thought I'd go through reasonably quickly. We cover all of science, but we're mostly bio and health. The organization grew up in the bio area. So probably, I don't know, 80% of everything we publish is bio and health. We make rapid editorial decisions. We publish now daily, and we're doing about 70 articles a day. We do things like we have full color throughout, no extra charge to the authors. Papers can be unlimited extent. We literally have published papers that are 70, 80, 90 pages long. We allow unlimited supplementary materials. So the single file size, I think, is 100 megabytes, and then we can have any number of supplementary materials. We make use of a lot of Web 2.0 features, and in this respect, probably PLOS One was reasonably pioneering, so they launched with things like comments, notes, star ratings on the article. And we use a lot of Web 2.0 tools. So we have an EdBoard discussion forum, we have a blog, we have a Twitter stream for Envy, Rooms, Facebook, and so on. We try and encourage debate and commenting, although actually, in reality, it's not happened very much. But there is comment threads on the articles, and we are trying to encourage more of that still. We use the most liberal Creative Commons license, so we allow commercial reuse. And we have an open source platform. So the publishing platform is open source, and we actually have two open APIs on it now. So anything you can access through our advanced search is available in the API, and ALM, which is Article Level Metrics, we have an API for that. And we've been partnering with Mendeley. You heard from Ian yesterday. We have a Mendeley PLOS API binary battle competition going on. It's closing next week, so get your entries in. Okay, so the full PLOS One, so those are sort of some of the features of PLOS One, but the really interesting thing, like Mark said about PLOS One, is actually the editorial criteria. So specifically, the journal asks some very objective questions. Is the work rigorous? Is it scientific? Does it deserve to be published? Those kind of questions. And we do accept negative results, for instance. If the work is done scientifically and comes to a negative conclusion, then that's within scope. We explicitly don't ask these subjective questions of how impactful is the work? Is it a broad readership? Is it a great degree of advance? Those kind of questions. The thinking there is that those are very subjective questions. They're not appropriate to make a decision on whether or not to publish. You don't need to have the answer to those questions to decide whether it's scientific and deserves to be published. So you make that decision first, and then you publish it, and then the idea is that the world, as it were, figures out for themselves whether it's important to them, and each individual in the world will have a different criteria of whether it's impactful to them. So effectively what it means is everything that deserves to be published will be published by the journal. Another way of saying it sometimes is, you know, if you could see this article anywhere in the scientific literature, published by, as it were, a regular journal, then PLOS ONE would be interested in publishing that article as well. We are only sciences, we're not humanities and social sciences, and we're only a research article journal, so we don't do review articles, that kind of thing. But what this means, of course, and then with the scalable business model that Mark mentioned, the author publication fee, the journal just isn't artificially limited in size. It can grow to any size depending simply on the number of submissions it gets. And then we provide online tools to filter and evaluate the content after publication, and I'll show you some of those as well. Okay, so sometimes we're criticized as having some sort of peer review light model, and that's absolutely not the case. So the peer review that we do is as rigorous as any other peer reviewed journal. It simply asks a very specific set of questions. Is it scientific to have published? If that means peer review light, then that's, you know, that's a misnomer. We simply don't ask those very subjective questions afterwards of, and how good is it on some imaginary scale? But as part of our peer review process, we have what we think of as incredibly high standards on everything we do. So for instance, ethical standards in the peer review process, in the submission process, are queried and enforced. So we'd specifically ask authors to outline what their ethical criteria was, for instance, experimenting on animals, and we make sure it meets the correct national guidelines. Financial disclosures, it's a required field in our submission. Authors have to disclose where their funding comes from, and that gets published on the paper. Competing interests, authors are required to state any competing interest, and that gets published on the paper. We adhere to the ICMJ authorship status definitions, and again, those are looked into and published on the paper. We enforce open data sharing, so some of our editorial criteria is that the underlying data should be open as well, and we enforce that. When people don't make their data available, we enter into a dispute process with them and can retract papers based on that. We rigorously enforce community standards, so one here is the consort guidelines, for instance, for clinical trials. So again, we make sure that submissions meet the standards. We name the academic editor on every single paper, so it's not a secretive process. There's a named individual who's vetted and approved that article. We have an editorial dispute process. We do employ professional editors, and they will actually go into a paper when there's been an accusation of plagiarism or something like that and initiate a dispute where they would actually go to the university and start an investigation. Again, one of the, as it were, criticisms of open access is that isn't it just a pay-to-publish model? And it's not, of course. The ability to pay does not influence the ability to publish. We're a not-for-profit, so actually we allow people to take a fee waiver for any reason. And editorial staff are blinded from any information about the payments on the article. We even go so far as we have some standards around, for instance, we don't accept papers funded by the tobacco industry. And we don't accept advertising for pharmaceutical products. So we believe, you know, that we have incredibly high ethical standards and probably, you know, higher than many journals out there. And all of these are, you know, public and enforced. So what kind of output do we put out? If you look at the citations to our journal, this is a really impressive story, I think. So if you look at all articles that are 1 year or older in the journal right now, And that's simply because you wouldn't expect citations to build up on articles that are less than a year old. Over three quarters now have at least one citation. 20% of the corpus has 9 or more citations, and 10 have 15 or more. We do have articles published now that have over 200 citations. So from a sort of traditional citation metric, the quality of the output is very high. From a downloads point of view, we have A lot of articles with a lot of downloads. So you probably know we provide our usage metrics on the article, but we have 250 articles that have more than 10,000 downloads. We have one that has 200,000 downloads now. We've published many Nobel laureates, and we've won one Ig Nobel Award, which coincidentally is the one that has more than 200,000 downloads. And we win a lot of awards for sort of best of articles from societies. We won, well, not we didn't, the authors of the paper won one just yesterday, actually, that was made public. So the quality of the output, we would say, is very high. And what about the quantity of the output? This is a graph that I've shown a few times now, perhaps originally at the SSP meeting in Boston in June. And this shows the quarterly publications of PLOS One since launch. Q4 2006 over on the left, that's we launched on December 20th, 2006. And the far right-hand point is the quarter that we're about to leave in 10 days' time. And there's, I guess, there's four interesting points actually on this graph. So in the first year of publication, you see there in 2007, we actually published 1,231 articles. Now there's less than 100 articles in the world, 100 journals rather, in the world that publish more than 1,000 articles a year. And if we define mega as in the thousands, you can see that in the very first year of full publication, 07, we were already publishing more than 99.7% of all journals in the world. Next interesting point, you can see we then have several very linear years of publication output growth. 2010, we published 6,784 articles. That made us the largest journal in the world at that point. So the next largest is, I think, PhysRevB, and they do about 5,500. So at that point, and that's before the break in the graph that you can see where the performance changes, we were already the largest journal in the world and doing fine. The break in the graph is the day we got an impact factor. And hopefully I don't need to tell this room what our stance on the impact factor is, but we fundamentally disagree with it as a metric for journal publication in general. And in particular on this journal, it's completely meaningless. But it's very important to the outside world. So, people get cash bonuses based on publishing in a journal with an impact factor. You can't get a PhD in China without doing so, that kind of thing. So the day we got an impact factor, our submission behavior changed, and then you can see what it did. But it's been incredibly linear since then. So that was the middle of 2010 we got that, and the graph remains incredibly straight for the last sort of 5 points. And in 2011, this year, we're going to publish about 14,000 articles. So PubMed indexes about 920,000 articles a year, something like that, roughly a million. So this year, PLOS One alone is going to make up about 1.6% of the sort of 2011 indexed output of PubMed, which is incredible. I mean, if you call that the scientific and technical literature, roughly a million articles, this one journal is now 1.5% of STM literature out of 25,000 journals in the universe. And that graph continues. And the reason it continues is because I know what the submissions are. So this is a graph that I don't show very often, but these are the submissions. So I'll just flick back. There's the publications and submissions. So you can see right now we're in a quarter where we're receiving about 8,000 submissions a quarter. So we're bumping up against 3,000 submissions a month right now. And again, that graph is linear and potentially is even accelerating there. So I think we're reasonably confident that next year our publication output will remain probably on that curve that you saw before. So potentially we're publishing 3% of the literature next year. Another interesting thing, and I just drew this for fun, I was drawing the usage of the journal. So this is the quarterly usage, the online downloads, basically. That's the black line, and it's going up. So right now we get perhaps 1.5 million usage events a month, so 4.5 million a quarter. And I just put that alongside the cumulative size of the corpus. And I've never drawn this graph before, actually, but it's surprisingly exponential, that pink line. But we're about to hit 25,000 total published articles. We should do that on Monday or Tuesday. Okay, so that is, as it were, our performance to date. Are we a first choice journal? So again, one of the criticisms we've had sort of in this situation of being the first mega journal is that we're a dumping ground. And Actually, we see no evidence of that whatsoever. So we have an annual author survey. In 2010, published authors reported that we were the first choice journal for 41% of them. So 41% of our published authors came to us first, and we were, as it were, the first or second choice for three quarters of all authors. So we're certainly not the last journal in a long chain. We're the first, second, or third choice for pretty much all of them, 92%. And those trends have been increasing. So the previous year, that 41% was lower. I can't remember the exact number, but the trend is increasing. We're increasingly becoming more of a first choice journal for people. Wherever we weren't the first choice was usually some sort of aspirational title like Nature or Science. And anecdotally, we do hear that people sort of try their hand at Nature or Science. They spend 6 months getting rejected and say, well, I'm just going straight to PLOS One. I'll have a fast, fair process and get published. So that's anecdotal, but I think we see some evidence of that. And we're not a journal of rejected content, for instance. We take internal transfers from our other titles, but it's less than 200 a month. So 7% of our submissions come from internal transfers from the other PLOS journals. So the rest are genuinely coming from de novo submissions. And the authors are happy. So again, the same survey, we asked them, how would you characterize your overall experience? And it was a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 was the best publishing experience I've ever had, and 5 was the worst. And 89% of those people, those published authors, scored us a 1 or a 2 on that scale of 5. I think people who said it was one of the worst experiences was well less than 1%. So on average, the authors are incredibly happy with the experience they're getting at PLOS One. I thought I'd talk quickly about our rejection rate, and I find this interesting. So our rejection rate, and it's entirely sort of a natural rejection rate of the community. So our editorial board, we don't tell them how much we want them to accept or reject. We just give them the content for them to peer review. They peer review it and make a decision. And on average, it seems we reject about 30 to 35% of all submissions. And a friend of mine sent me this link. This is a study that was done in 1971. And in my mind, this is like sort of an ice core in publishing. This is looking back in an era of time before the impact factor had distorted, as it were, publication practices, when there wasn't perhaps such a pressure to publish impactful work in some way. Back then, these people studied the biological sciences, and they only looked at 12 journals, admittedly. But they found that the average rejection rate in that period was 29%, which is basically what our current rejection rate is. So it almost feels like that's, as it were, the natural amount of stuff that should be rejected that's unpublishable in the publishing world. And I can't put any great store by that. I've not even read the paper, but I thought this was a really interesting little statistic that came out so close to ours. And it's certainly, it's not the case for other fields. Okay, so the basic process we operate, and this is where I'm sort of telling you how we work and what our lessons have learned. So effectively, we operate a conveyor belt process. Because the journal is so vast, you really can't have, as it were, a single staff member handle a single paper all the way through the process and do everything on it. So what we tend to do is we break our team into functional groups, and we have a group of people that do one part of the process. The paper then moves through the process to another stage, and another group handles it. So the first stage is tech check. So a paper is submitted, and it goes to a technical check process. We have a big checklist of like 46 items that admin staff basically go through. Sorry. And that's a staff of people that are doing literally this one chunk of the workflow. And they're looking at it for things like, does the abstract on the paper match the abstract that was submitted in the peer review system? Does it meet its various standards that it says for ethics and so on? It's a long checklist. So they do that. Then it moves to what we call an editorial scan process. And this is, we do actually employ professional staff editors. We have 4 of them on staff. These are sort of postdoc level professional editors. And in this particular part of the process, this group of people, effectively, they look at each article and they make some sort of high level, with their expert knowledge, determination of things that are interesting about that article, that perhaps we want to transmit to the academic editor who's going to handle the paper. This looks like a particularly controversial area. Make sure you get referees in that field, or those kind of questions. And they're looking for just the content that's coming into the journal, so we get an editorial overview of what's going on. But that's an important step in our process. Then the paper gets assigned to an academic editor. We have just over 2,000 academic editors now. And the way that works is when a paper is submitted by the author tags it against a taxonomy. We have 5,200 terms in the taxonomy, and the author says what the paper's about. On the other side of the equation, the editor themselves have tagged their personal expertise against the same taxonomy. We have some software that does an overlap analysis, you know, and if this editor has 10 matching taxonomy terms with that paper, then perhaps they're the most qualified editor to handle the paper. And the system then sends them an email saying, will you handle the paper? And then it goes down a chain of people who are increasingly less qualified to handle the paper until one accepts, and hopefully, obviously, the person at the top does accept. But there's no hierarchy in that editorial board. So a traditional journal might have the editor-in-chief look at everything, who then assigns it to section editors, who then assign it to an academic editor, and so on. So we don't do that. All 2,000 people are completely flat in the chain. There's no hierarchy above them, nobody who's in charge of them. So if they take on a paper, they have sole responsibility to do the peer review on that paper and make an editorial decision. We do have what we call section editors, but they're not part of a hierarchy. They're sort of advisors within a section. That academic editor is editorially independent, so again, we don't tell them what to do in any way. They're responsible for using the system, the peer review system, and finding peer reviewers. On average, they find about 1.9, so two peer reviewers for a paper. And they tend to operate a very traditional process. You know, they have the ability, the editors, to actually accept a paper without peer review. That's built into our criteria because the assumption is they're an expert in the field and can make a decision on the worthiness of that paper. But typically, they don't. Well less than 5% of our articles go that route, and the vast majority are sort of traditionally peer-reviewed. Okay, so lessons learned. So the editorial board, having such a large editorial board across such a large sort of swathe of subject areas is hard. The ed board gets spread very thin, and as a result, you need to have ed board members, as it were, in waiting for an area in which you may only get one submission a year. So that's hard. So when you're setting up these journals, you need to worry about how that is going to work. As the size of the ed board increases, it becomes increasingly hard to actually match the right paper to the right academic editor. We now have 3,000 submissions a month and 2,000 academic editors, and doing that overlap analysis isn't necessarily the best way anymore, and it is difficult. With such a large group, and especially given that they're editorially independent, it requires actual work, active work on the part of the publisher to enforce standards and training across the group so that the decisions are made consistently. And we don't have this sort of bureaucracy, this layer of editorial board. So it becomes somewhat hard to have the board acting cohesively. We tend to have, editors thinking that they'll take one, one route, one decision type. And so we do a lot of oversight and checking on the group, and we try and keep the board cohesive. We have an editorial discussion forum, for instance, but that requires real work. So as you launch and grow your sort of mega journals, you're going to need to worry about these issues. This is just a screenshot of our editorial board discussion forum. So we have a private discussion forum that anyone can access and ask questions, and there's often vigorous debate going on there. Lessons learned relating to the size. As the volume of the output increases, and we're now publishing 1,400 articles a month, it's hard to navigate the corpus from a user's point of view. We're a journal that covers all of science, publishing 70 articles a day, and we haven't differentiated or stratified those articles based on quality. So as a reader, when you come in, you don't know what is, as it were, the best stuff to read, and you can't even find the stuff within your subject area very easily. So that requires your active thought and development on the side of your platform. Also, niche areas are going to need special attention. So when you publish 70 articles a day, how do you take care of that one little tiny article, or one tiny subject area rather, that may only get one article a week? And how do you direct people towards that area? And another thing, it's harder to press release all press-worthy papers. We can't press release 1,300 articles a month. So we typically press release about 3 or 4 a week maximum. But we've been doing 3 or 4 a week maximum since 3 or 4 years ago. So there's presumably a quantity of papers that would have deserved a press release, and they simply don't get them. And the press in general, of course, would become sort of immune to plus one press releases if they saw too many of them. Another lesson, I think, is that as the journal becomes more visible, it becomes subject to a lot greater scrutiny. So we get a lot of eyeballs on us, we get a lot of scrutiny, a lot of criticism. But also we're held to perhaps higher standards than an average journal, which might sort of be lost amongst the shoal of journals. So that's important. You need to have high standards when you're running one of these journals, because you're going to be held to them. And this is interesting as well. So this is basically just the law of averages. But as the journal becomes bigger, you know, the amount of sort of long-tail problems you have in that journal just increases in quantity. The long tail's always there, but sort of the size goes up. And so there's always going to be criticism about a published paper you've made, and Nature and Science get criticism as well. But you'll have some quantity of papers that sit in your long tail and get criticism, and you need to have a robust process to, you know, stand by your articles. And the same for, you know, the average time spent in the process. So, of course, there's a bell curve of how long things take to pass through, and somebody's always going to be at the end, and they're going to complain because they're way off at the average of your time, for instance. So you're going to have to worry about those kind of issues as well. And then I thought I'd quickly talk about some of the navigation tools that we built. So one is particularly interesting is collections. We have the functionality within the journal to tag any articles as being within a certain subject area. So effectively, you can imagine it as a journal within a journal. So this is a Brain Mapper Society that simply look across the corpus of everything we've published, as it were, pick out all the content we've published that are relating to brain mappers. They package it together and put it in a sort of little sub-collection within PLOS One and call that their society journal, for instance. And that's fascinating when you have a journal like this and you can do that. Another experiment we've got going on is hubs. So we have a PLOS hub for biodiversity. And the idea here is actually that this aggregates content from across many open access publishers and brings it together. But it puts on that sort of layer of expert knowledge. So experts select the best biodiversity articles and put them in this one place. This is what it looks like. So this is a Biomed Central article, for instance, sitting in a PLOS hub. And the other one, of course, is our article level metrics, which we're sort of in the process of rethinking as alt metrics, like we heard from Dario yesterday. But these are automated quality metrics, usage, citations, bookmarks, so on. But what we've done is we've actually integrated this into our search functionality. So if you go to our advanced search now, you can sort the search by views, for example, and where it says Scopus 25, if you hover over the thing that says citations, yes, it tells you the number of citations that articles have right within the search functionality. So it's using article level metrics to improve the navigation of the content. So I wanted to make a couple of quick points about why it's important to operate the full, as it were, PLOS One model, the non-selective model. And these are a couple of just instructive things, I think. So the first here is a tweet that came out the other week. So this person's paper was previously rejected by another journal, P-Methods, because they weren't using a sexy enough organism. And there's another study just out recently by Danielle Finelli, which was making the point that the pressure for publishing positive results is putting science under threat. So PLOS One sort of solves both of those problems with our criteria. So effectively, when you've got the full PLOS One model, you improve the author experience so that they only have to go through a single round of review and decision. The reviewer as well only has to review that paper once. Some reviewers end up seeing the same paper five times as it goes through five journals, and so that's reduced. You know, in our opinion, the subjective filtering of content before publication for quality is an outmoded way of trying to do things. There's better ways to do that now. There's no economic reason for artificially limiting the size of the journal. Each article pays for itself. And in general, it just provides a healthier publishing environment. With the PLOS One model, you can now publish negative results. You can publish stuff on non-sexy topics. So the advantages of being a mega journal, effectively, you could imagine you could apply the same editorial criteria to a collection of smaller journals, and I think we're going to hear about some of that later today. But when you're one big mega journal, you have some inherent advantages. So you only need to be indexed once, for instance, not 20, 30 times. Authors only need to be evaluated once against a common sort of criteria that they're used to. As a single large journal, you get very high visibility. You get repeat authorship. People keep coming back to you. You can consolidate many of the aspects of your journal. There's just an inherent economy of scale. You don't have to have, you know, many, many marketing plans, many Twitter streams, and so on. And one interesting thing, you know, is you have the opportunity to set consistent standards in a field, which, because of your size, could become the de facto standard. So you can actually improve the quality of, you know, publication in an area just by being so large. And as a result, you know, in a mega journal, we really have sort of a unique chance to reinvent the way publishing is done in the world. Some of the consequences, and these are really open questions, actually. So I don't have the answer to these, but when you're publishing 5% for literature, 3% that we might do next year, are you actually a journal anymore, or are you just a big database? And what does that actually mean? When you're publishing a lot more articles than your organization, and PLOS One clearly does that, but some of these other mega journals have the real potential to publish more than the rest of their organization combined, what does that mean to your organizational structure? You know, how are you going to interact with your colleagues and your other journals? When we reach this point that I'm, you know, reasonably confident is going to happen, we get to a place where there's just a small number of very huge journals, and perhaps it's, you know, less than 100 journals publishing most of the content. How do those journals differentiate themselves? If they all look a bit like PLOS One and do something similar, same speed, same open access model and everything, how are we going to differentiate ourselves and compete? And what does that mean for the current journal ecosystem when we're in that world? There's 25,000 journals right now. There might only be 100 in 5 or 10 years' time. And I know I've run out of time, Mark, so I see you hovering. Okay, so this is just a quick sort of conceptual thing, but in an open access journal which contains mega journals, you've got the mega journals on the right and you've got all other open access journals on the left. So the difference here, of course, is the mega journals haven't differentiated their content based on quality or impact, and the journals on the left have, but it's all pumped into this big cloud of open access content, which has, as it were, the same copyright license. So you've now got a cloud of stuff that the world has to deal with, some of which has had some quality indicator put on it by one of the 6,000 journals, and some of it, perhaps most of it, hasn't. So what that means is, you know, new services are going to evolve, like Mendeley, that are just going to poke into that cloud and look for the quality content, or perhaps build an algorithm that picks out all the best stuff, or perhaps somebody even goes in and re-reviews that content to the standard of Nature, or something like that. And so the, you know, the possibilities in this future are really interesting, I think, and we don't really know, of course, where it's going to go. And this is my last slide. So the take-home message is, you know, I really think, you know, when I see our growth and the way we've been going and just the consistent straight line that we're on, I really think we're on a path to, you know, transform the publishing landscape with these products. And especially now that a lot of other publishers are launching the same thing, and let's hope they grow, you know, at a similar rate to PLOS One, because, you know, the potential for doing change in the publishing landscape, and beneficial change, of course, is huge. You know, it's scary for the established marketplace, I think, of course, but the potential for improving how we do things, for speeding up the process, for getting us to an open access future much faster is massive. Another take-home message is, and I can tell you, I wasn't this gray 4 years ago. It isn't easy to run a mega journal. You know, there's a lot of problems that you encounter that you just wouldn't have in a journal that's only handling 100 manuscripts a year. So, you know, as people launching mega journals, you're going to have to plan for rapid growth. You're going to have to constantly evolve and reinvent your processes. You should build scalable structures, scale and plan today for something that's going to be 10 times as big tomorrow. And you're going to be very visible. And you'll get scrutinized. And I think, you know, the last point is really important. You know, if we are going to reinvent academic publishing in this route, that has great responsibility. You know, we don't want to screw up the publishing ecosystem to the extent that everything breaks. We want to reinvent and improve it, but we absolutely owe it to academia to have, you know, the highest standards for publishing their content that we can, and do it in the best possible way. So that's really important. You know, I think as we go in the future, we as it were, as a group of open access mega journals, are going to have to be really diligent, I think, about how we do it. And that's it. Thank you.
Jörg, I had a nice experience of publishing twice in your journal. I was wondering how you motivate reviewers, because with the huge numbers of reviews, and I know in many traditional high-quality journals, there's a career stage of going from being reviewer to associate editor and senior editor, which motivates.
Yeah.
But how can you motivate these vast numbers of... Do you pay any fees for your...
So when you say reviewers, I think you mean our academic editors. And then they find peer reviewers. So it's a pretty traditional process. So we don't pay our academic editors. Their motivation is simply to sort of be on the editorial board of a game-changing journal. They get named on each article so that there is some academic credit, as it were, available to them for handling papers with us. We're very inclusive. We really make sure we're responsive to our editorial board. We have a private discussion forum where they can ask any questions. We treat them as our, as it were, VIPs. At least I hope we do. Treat them as our VIPs, and they get, you know, good experience by working with us. They get insight into the workings of the journal and so on. And then they themselves are responsible to go out and find, on average, 2 peer reviewers per paper. And again, those peer reviewers aren't paid. That's just part of, as it were, the regular quid pro quo of you know, being an academic and reviewing articles for free because somebody else will review your articles. So we operate very much like a traditional journal in that sense.
I'm just curious as... I'm curious, as having been an editor, and so on, one of the parts of the whole peer review process is not only selecting articles, but also, in many cases, there's an iterative process where articles get better, clearer, little minor problems are fixed, and so on. Does any of that go on in Plus One, or do you see that as a something that's been lost by this process?
Yeah, so in theory, that shouldn't go on in Plus One. In theory, you know, if the first draft is acceptable science and deserves to be published, it shouldn't go back to the author to be improved still further. In reality, most stuff does go back for at least one revision. I think the average is like 1.2 revisions for the journal. And what that is, I think, it's a sort of traditional pushback from the editorial board operating in a somewhat traditional mindset. So we try and encourage people not to do that. It does happen, and it's sort of hard and inevitable that it happens, but it shouldn't happen, actually. If it's scientifically sound and it meets, you know, the minimum bar, whatever that is, you shouldn't send it back to do an extra experiment to make it even more, you know, rigorous in some way if it's already meets the criteria.
Yeah. I don't think so much in terms of another experiment necessarily, that it could be that, but just sometimes things are not clear, there's the editor sees that, or the reviewer sees it, you can misinterpret and so on,
I see the value. Yeah, so I think that does happen, and that deserves to happen. You know, if one of our criteria is it should be written in legible English to a standard that a reader can follow the conclusions and the experiments. So things, I think, legitimately go back in order to improve, as it were, the clarification of the text and that kind of thing. That's, yeah.
Peter, I was wondering what kind of infrastructure you have for the peer review process. I mean, my journals receive about 35,000 manuscripts a year, so next year you'll surpass us, and we publish about 19,000 total. Now, we have a very integrated system that keeps track of the reviews, all our referees, so we have like 70,000 referees in our database. Do you have that type of infrastructure help your academic editors?
We use Ares Editorial Manager, so one of the two leading peer review systems. And again, you know, we pay money to maintain that process. We have staff that you know maintain it and keep it running. And we do a lot of reporting off of that. So we have a very traditional sort of real publishing infrastructure behind the process. Yeah.
Right, thanks very much. I think we probably should move on.
Yep, and I'm here this evening and things, so feel free to come find me.
Well, maybe there's after the second session, there might